If we could just go back for a moment, what are your recollections of the Piasecki Corporation and the helicopters that they were building at that time from an engineering perspective?
Well, I think our general knowledge of helicopters was fairly limited, my own and other people. You know, we had the bells, we were gaining a knowledge. I personally had never operated a helicopter as an engineer in a squadron or anything like that. Because there was a lot of help going on, which was really rather more important at that time, the Banshee, the Tracker, those two were the two which I think one devoted one's mental activity to more than that.
Do you, was the RCN becoming more interested in helicopters as the Korean War was wearing on? I know that the Americans were particularly happy with the service that they were getting from their helicopters during the war, primarily in a medical rescue role. But I know that a number of Canadian officers had seen these aircraft.
I left just after the outbreak of the Korean War. When did the Korean War break out?
And ended in 53.
And ended in 53. Okay. There was some connection with the Korean War, and I didn't know what it was. It was regarding the Sea Fairies, that's right. It was another thing altogether, which somebody raised in that book. Why we bought so many, and they didn't really explain why in that book.
Oh, I see. All right.
But that's incidental to this. I know why we did buy the extra Sea Furies and wasn't quoted in there, quoted as if we were a bit stupid.
Oh, I see. All right.
We had bought the S-55s by this time, hadn't we?
Yes, because... The S-55s came along a little bit later. They came along in we started procuring the S-55s in the
mid-1950s. Mid-1950s, yeah.
But first we had procured the Bell 47 helicopter and the Hupp helicopter for the icebreaker for the utility role. But we were also investigating a number of other helicopters.
That's
at the
right,
same
because
time.
I remember going down to Sikorsky's and meeting Sikorsky's, and meeting Igor Sikorsky at that time.
In the early
50s, yes, before I left Ottawa in 53.
Right, because they were building the S-51, and then their next helicopter...
Did we have S-51s? I can't remember. Did we have an S-51?
I think that we had one for a short period of time, but the S-55s followed very shortly thereafter, which was a much better aircraft. We had the H-04S-2.
That's right.
And then we had the H-04S-3, which was a more modern... variant of that Sikorsky airframe.
But we bought some S-51s, didn't we? This is why I'm thinking of I recall going down when we were buying S-51s.
Right, we were looking at the S-51s to procure from Sikorsky at virtually the same time.
Yeah, okay.
So you had an opportunity to do quite a bit of traveling to visit the aircraft plants down in the States and visiting with Igor Sikorsky and Frank Piasecki.
Yeah.
Did you ever visit the Cayman helicopter?
Not in the early days, later on.
Later on.
When we were in the Cayman.
Was the front runner before the CC came.
I can tell you that I've written some stuff on that, why we went for the command. Why we changed.
All right, we'll get
I
to that.
I can tell you that later.
All right,
it's
sure.
The more interesting part of me, and the more part I've got a better memory of that in the early days.
Okay. So during your time then in headquarters from 50 to 53, we didn't actually procure the Hupp helicopter because of the numerous technical problems with that aircraft, But we did procure the Bell 47 helicopter for the utility
right.
role.
We got the Bell 47s, and I think I was, I remember, well, there wasn't bad blood, but I remember having some pretty heavy discussions on the HOP because they wanted the HOP very badly.
They thought that it would be a more useful helicopter for the RCN than the Bell.
Oh, sure. It turned out to be a good one. Once they'd overcome all their problems.
Particularly for operating off the icebreaker.
Yes, that's right.
Because if I remember, the Bell 47 was an open canopy.
Oh, that's right.
On either side, there were no doors there. They had the plexiglass bubble canopy.
That's right.
Which is not exactly ideal for operating in the far north, and the HOP certainly would have been better for that. But the RCN did see a role for the Bell 47, I guess, in a utility capacity.
I think so, and I think also there was an early way of getting experience in rotary wing, because Dennis Foley's experience was limited to Dennis,
right?
and he'd been in the very early stages.
Right, he was trained as a helicopter pilot for the RN in the latter stages of World War II.
Yeah.
1944, I think he went down to.
He was an engineer who managed to sneak in and get some flying training.
And became one of the first qualified helicopter pilots in the RCN.
Yeah.
So do you remember having worked closely with Bell helicopters when we were going through the procurement process?
Oh, yes. I visited Bell two or three times down in Buffalo, weren't they? I remember going down on a holiday with a lot of my kids and getting a somewhere near, they were just near Niagara, weren't they? Down
right.
There, and spending a day or two down there while Marion and the kids were on a lake down there. We rented a bungalow for a couple of days or something. I can remember that, you know.
Right.
And went all around Bells. And I can't remember the Bell people though very well.
I don't remember ever seeing any reports about problems with the Bell aircraft at all.
No, I don't think we had any difference of opinions at all on the Bell. I think we were all in agreement that if that was the airplane you wanted, that was the, you know...
The one to purchase.
That was the one to purchase.
I don't remember ever seeing any reports of any technical problems with that aircraft either. It seemed to pass all of its tests and was providing very good service for the Americans during the Korean War in a medical rescue role. So it seemed more than capable of carrying out utility role for the RCN.
That's right.
So many of our early helicopter pilots were receiving their training on this particular aircraft and was eventually procured and became the primary aircraft, I think, for our utility squadron based out in Shearwater. So following your time in headquarters, you left in August 1953,
yeah.
And where did you go? What was your next posting?
My next place was the Royal Naval Staff College at Greenwich, and I believe I was the first engineer they ever sent to the Royal Naval Staff College.
And you were there for a year?
No, yeah, about 6 months.
About 6 months. And your
next... Can I tell you a little story
sure.
about the staff college?
Yes, that's fine.
There was an aviator went on it, Joe McBrien, who later joined the Canada Air.
All right.
And Joe had picked up an American decoration during the World War. I don't know if you've ever met Joe.
No, I don't. I'm not familiar with that name.
He joined... and we did it together. There was another flyer on it. I can't remember who. Can't remember who it was. It was. Earnshaw was on it, but there was another guy. But anyway, Joe reminds me because we did the course together, and he joined Canada Air. So when he quit and joined Canada Air, and years later I met him. And he Canadair had sent him to Harvard Business College. And I said to him, what did they teach you at Harvard Business College? And he said, I'll tell you. He said, they taught me exactly the same thing as they taught me at the Greenwich Staff College. Different words, but the same thing.
That's very interesting.
That's interesting. And so I did the Staff College. And what had happened then was that I was told I had, before I left Canada, they said I was coming back and going to either Ontario or Quebec to get a Marine Certificate of Competency and the Marine Watchkeeping Certificate. And I said to the people, if I have to do this as a commander, which it's usually done as a two-striper, I would like to do it away from home. If I'm going to make a bloody fool of myself as a commander, I can always remember this argument with personnel. And they said, well, and I said, well, I'm going to be in England. Ask the Royal Navy if I can do it in one of their ships. I'd rather do it for my personal living over there. So they agreed. And I was very fortunate in that I was told I was joining the cruiser Mediterranean, the cruiser Bermuda that was in the Mediterranean. Marion and all the kids were over at this time. And then I got a letter from the chief engineer of Bermuda, who was an old friend of mine. He'd been a flying plumber with the Royal Navy, see.
Right.
And he wrote me a delightful letter. He said, John, I hear you're going to come and learn to be a marine engineer in my ship. He said, when you come to Malta, do you want to lead the gentleman's life, or do you want to learn it the hard way? I went back and told him, I'd like to learn it the hard way, providing it didn't interfere with the gentleman's life. And we had a wonderful 6 months in Malta.
During your time in the Mediterranean, do you have any recollections of the RN and Fleet Air Arm, and specifically helicopters?
No, none at all.
Conducting any exercises or training there?
No, we were. They weren't doing anything. I knew the commander of Halfar, I think so, there was a naval base there, air base, but no, I don't recall any of it. But I was totally involved in marine engineering, thoroughly enjoying it.
Now, why was the decision made to send you off for this training to become a marine engineer? You were already had extensive experience in training as an engineer in the UK, and now you're going off to do marine engineering.
Well, because the idea was that we'd followed the British pattern that was happening in those days, that they all AEs in England went to management training where they did marine and air, or they elected to do air separately, and we were following the same training. We were training engineers. Now, we had began sending some of our AEs, but this time we built up a corps of AEs like Neil Smith and other people who had no marine background, and they were being sent off. And it was a policy I supported when I was in Ottawa, because I thought they'd have better chance of promotion. You know, you were in a dead group if you just stayed in that one little category in the Navy. And that's really why they told me I would do it, because if I'd been telling the others to do it, it was only right that I should do it. And I was all for it. I had no objections at all. Jerry Daniel had already got his.
Right.
Jerry and I kept changing places. He took over from me at Shearwater, and then he took over from me in Ottawa, and then I went.
I traced that through all the documents. Now, would have you been one of the last to go off and receive that training with the RN? Because we're starting to switch more and more towards the USN.
Yeah, I think the only reason it was done, because I happened to be in England, and so it was an opportunity to. For me, I thought it was an easier way to do it.
Right. I mean,
I don't know.
I know that most of our pilots receive their training in the USN, but the odd person got trained by the RN Fleet Air Arm during this time period too. But
no, I think the mine was totally unrelated. It was just that I said I would like to do it away from home. All the others did it in Canadian ships. But so they were all doing it at a rank lower than myself.
Right.
I think I was the only one who got it as a commander.
So following this six-month training in HMS Bermuda, you came back to Canada and went to HM Dockyard Chatham for dockyard
experience. No, I came back. No, I'm Bermuda. I was still in the Mediterranean.
So, right.
So we came back to England. We did some more courses. From there, I did a series of courses. I went down to Manhattan and did a short course. I moved around industry. I even went over and saw Bonaventure Building.
Well, you eventually became technical representative, the RCN's technical representative when she was there building.
Yes, we had quite a big staff there. Bill Christie's just written a story on it, have you?
I have not seen that.
Oh, yeah, I only got it the other day.
Oh, did you?
Or then they said to go to get some dockyard experience while you're over there. I didn't know why they didn't bring me back to Canada, but they said we were over there, you might as well go to Chatham Dockyard and get in. And that finished, and we didn't know where we were going, and my wife said to me, well, where are we going? And I said, well, I don't know. She said, we should rank and ask somebody. And I said, well, I don't know, rise from the desk at the wrong moment or something. And then let them, they know I'm here. And the next day I went out one morning, and she said, I got back, she said, Bob has called from the London office. They want to know where you're going. And I said, yeah, tell me. He said, you get the Bonaventure, because that's the one job I wanted. Because I'd been on the original purchase team back in 53 on Bonaventure.
Oh, okay, right. When you were in Ottawa as ACNTS Air?
That's right.
All right. So you spent almost 2 years as the RCN's technical representative during the building of Bonaventure.
That's right.
And she would have been much modernized with the mirror landing system.
Well, she was rebuilt. She was, you know, she wasn't there, you know. When we... See, the ship was half built. And
right.
We stopped it at the end of the war. There was a number of other carriers. I think the Melbourne was another one, the Australian one. And they just stopped them.
And sat there for a number of years.
And they sat there for a number of years. And of course, the technology had changed so much by this time.
Right, they were operating jet aircraft now as opposed to piston engine.
Well, we went over on a group led by Corporal, the guy who destroyed the destroyers, Roddy Baker was there. I saw an electrical fellow. On the purchase of it, because the
Baker, the naval constructor?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Roddy Baker, the great Roddy Baker. I can tell you a story of Roddy Baker that will make you laugh. I'll tell you it afterwards.
All right.
And we went to all around Admiralty and Bath. All these places about buying it, and I think I wrote the story in the Bonaventure book.
Oh, right.
So I won't bore you, but you can read it.
I'm familiar with the book.
Okay, well,
the name of the author escapes me at this point.
Yeah, I wrote it up there, so it's wasting your time. Yeah.
So you were off doing that for a couple of years, then you come back to Canada and become deputy superintendent HMC Dockyard Esquimalt.
Esquimalt.
All right. And you
I got my date pulled on that one. How do you go from Ireland to the West Coast, you know?
Very choice appointment. And you were there for 2 years before you go back to headquarters again and take up your old post.
Jerry Daniel,
Assistant Chief of Naval Technical Services Air again.
Yeah.
Now,
maybe I was up one rank by then, because Jerry got promoted in that rank.
Right. And now you are captain.
Hmm.
and you've come back, and it's August 1959, and you've been away from helicopters for 6 years, and now the RCN is actively investigating procuring helicopters to marry the helicopter to the destroyer, and we're into the program. We've gone through the Buckingham and the Ottawa trials. Now we're searching for a particular aircraft to procure.
That's right.
And that helicopter at that time was, what was the front runner when you came back and assumed?
It really wasn't there. We hadn't got the staff requirement or anything. That came up when we were there. And my recollection is, I'm just trying to remember, I don't think we were on the point of selecting at that time. I came back in 59. I don't think that arose until the early 60s.
Right.
We were working pretty close with staff all the time on this, where we were going. We finally got approval, and what had happened, our first choice of all of us was the Sea King. But it was not possible to put the Sea King on the deck. They just would not give us the room for the Sea King. And the only other helicopter that was supposed to be able to carry, meet the requirements, was the Command, I can't remember its designation, the Command...
The Command HOK-1 and HU-2K-1.
HU-2K-1, and those, yeah. And so we had a number of meetings with Command. Now, at that point in time, we had been reorganized, and Johnny Frank became the director of aircraft design and production, responsible to me. We then broke down into a new organization altogether, which is it's shown in that book.
Right.
And we were looking at the Command. He and I went to Command a number of times. He spent a lot more time than I did looking into this, because, you know, we were doing other things. Sikorsky Command said that they would meet our requirements, weight carrying requirements. We wrote a specification. We obtained some approval, and I'm very vague about what it was, to go ahead with the Command. I think staff agreed with us on that one. I think we had an agreement with staff.
Yes.
And we wrote the technical specification for the aircraft. John's group did. And he took it down to Sikorsky.
Would that director have been DNAR, Directorate of Naval Air Craft Requirements?
That was a staff directorate at that time, but not my director. My director, was the director of aircraft design and production.
All right.
Then I had a director of aircraft maintenance, a director of avionics. This is when we put the whole lot under one roof.
All right.
Right?
Okay.
Again, that's written up. I wrote that up in that book that you've got down there, if you're going to find it.
Oh, the certified serviceable.
Yeah.
All right.
The organizations that have taken place. And John either called me or came straight back. I can't remember what or which it was. And said they have refused to accept the specification for weight carrying, and we're in trouble. You know, we cannot meet their staff requirement. It won't meet the staff requirement. He and I talked about it. And then I remember saying, well, let me talk to Ted Edwards. No, let me talk to Sam Davis about this. And I called Sam and said, we had a serious problem now. could I come and see him? I must talk about getting more room. And I guess I told him a bit about the problem. And Sam was always an easy fellow to work with, and I called Ted Edwards, who was on the staff. He said, you better join in and come in. And the three of us went down. And Sam had got all the drawings laid out of the ship and things like that. And I can remember this. We were looking at it, and he said, look, it's just impossible to put you further. And we looked at going aft. I've written this up somewhere else.
Right.
And we started looking, and I said to him at the time, well, can't we just flip the outtakes in? And he was horrified. He said, well, they were actually destroyed the side by side funnel. And I said, well, you know, we have to do something, Sam. And so we started going down, you know, from deck to deck, turning over the drawings, and it didn't look as difficult as it appeared. So then we got agreement we would go that way. And I remember Sam said he'd have to put it up to Herbie Rainer, I think, who was then his chief of naval staff. I was an old destroyer man. He said, you know, I'd be up in there telling him, you know, side by side funnels, you better be there. A little bit of a joke, you know, I knew I wasn't there, but I can always remember he joked about it. And that's where the two funnels, side by side funnels, came from.
Right, okay. I remember, I guess it was Commander Jeffrey Brock, ACNS Air and Warfare.
Yeah, he was there at the time.
He was there, and he had suggested in his book that he had come up with that idea, but
he didn't come up with that idea. He wasn't even at the bloody meetings. He said in his book that was...
So it was suggested that the funnels be split in order to accommodate the hangar, move it forward.
Yeah, it was what they call the optics into the funnels, and you just had to bring them up and... There was no point putting them together again, the top.
Exactly. But what were the problems from your perspective with the command helicopter?
Well, it couldn't carry the weight. It was as simple as that.
Now, when you're talking about the staff requirement, this would have been the 1960 helicopter staff requirement.
I imagine so, yes.
Right, and so we'll get to this later, but I think the Sea King was the first helicopter out of a number of helicopters that were being looked at the time that actually met the 1960 helicopter requirement. And and the command came closest to the Sea King, but it had a number of problems as well. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, is one of the problems with the command that it couldn't meet the requirement to carry the full load?
That's right. Of the staff requirement of the avionics and all the torpedoes,
right.
They couldn't do both.
Right.
We do both roles, torpedo carrier and the search equipment. That's really what it was. It could do one or the other.
Right.
But they promised it would do both.
Both.
And then they came up with some ideas about putting another engine in and connecting it, and one saw a big cost involved, and it didn't really...
Would the RCN have had to have borne any of those costs to carry out the modifications if they procured?
They would have done that. The contractors don't do it for fun. Yeah, you pay one way or the other.
So
but that was one thing they said about the command. They would put another gas turbine into the system, a separate one. But that meant another development thing. We weren't trying to develop helicopters from scratch because the U.S. Navy had spent a tremendous amount of money on developing both those helicopters. I can't recall the figure, but I've seen something sticks in my mind. At the time we bought their first Sea King to get it to production level, it cost something like $300 million or something, you know, in that range.
Right.
And we certainly
couldn't afford that.
Couldn't get into that. You know, we didn't have the capability to do this, and there would have been, he wouldn't get the money, but I remember Jeffrey Bob, when somebody was in there, I'd taken somebody over to see him, a contractor, and I can't remember whether it was Sikorsky or Command. And he said, I'll give you $2 million to develop us the helicopters in. But the guy fell off the seat, and so did I. You know, when he called the American, maybe $300 million, the Sea Kings. You know, but then with Jeffrey.
Nowhere near enough money. I remember as I was doing my research, discovering that one of the problems with the Command too was that it could not carry the nuclear depth bomb as well as the two torpedoes and the sonobuoys and carry out both the ASW role and the search and rescue role, which is one of the things that this aircraft was designed for. Do you remember those sorts of discussions during your time back in